This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to the morning run. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me is Julian Ng. Good morning, Julian.
Good morning.
Good morning to all of you who are on your way to work or taking your kids to school or just getting out of bed. Either case, a good morning to you. I can't see anything out there. It looks all very dark.
As it would do at 6 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, it does. But it was raining earlier, so it's a bit
Which is nice. Cool. Yeah, I like it when it rains.
So do I. We have an exciting lineup for you this morning, including a breakfast grill in which Melissa Idris speaks to Dexter Lau, the executive director of Kim Tech Cheong. Kim Tech Cheong is a fast-growing distributor in East Malaysia and was listed on the ACE market of Bursa Malaysia back in 2015. So Melissa is going to be doing the grill this morning.
So what do they distribute again?
I'm wondering too. It's not my notes, but I we'll have a quick look.
I guess it's logistics.
It's a logistic company. Oh, FMCG goods.
Yeah.
We're told. Okay, so there it is. Fast-moving consumer goods. I think for those who are not familiar with that, their footprint outside of Malaysia, their multiple brands associated with them, Milo, Kit Kat, Maggi, Nestle, Crunch, Silky Girl, Revlon.
This would be a very important business because, you know, East Malaysia, they're still trying to build out their infrastructure over there. And for a specialist like Kim Tech Cheong to come into the scene to deliver these goods, very important to the people of East Malaysia. So they've got that whole footprint there in East Malaysia. And I guess that would be helped by the kind of infrastructure planned for East Malaysia, like the Borneo Highway. That's thousands of kilometers in being planned over there.
I wonder if, you know all this, the new developments in drone technology and, you know, the expectations that, you know, one day we'll be able to kind of order something online from your local supermarket and it will be delivered to you by a drone. I mean, whether these kinds of technologies would really be good for, you know, areas where roads are in short supply or there are real challenges when it comes to traditional transport because, you know, drones basically can go anywhere.
Yeah, I think that the drones allow you to just obviate the need to go to a mall or a supermarket and just receive your stuff in the comfort of your armchair. And I guess with that extra time, you can watch more TV, right?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, I don't, you know, there's still something. I must admit, Julian, I do sometimes go onto these online supermarket sites, but it's not as much fun. I think I associate going to the supermarket with sort of browsing some of the things that I buy. And I'm one of those people who goes to a supermarket without a shopping list, which is really bad.
The idea here is that you seek alternative sources of fun, like watching endless cat videos on YouTube. I mean, that you could use up your
And I know you're being serious here because... but, okay, so there is an issue with, you know, what happens when you free up all this time that you would devote to rather routine work. But there is something of discovery when it comes to supermarkets.
That's true.
Maybe for a lot of the basic stuff, you could still send it out, via... Do you do online shopping? In terms of supermarket shopping?
Yes, I do, but not in a very big way. I do go online and get stuff that on the impulse that sometimes I think about something. Like right now, what I want to get is a Google virtual reality goggles, goggles. It's really cool. It's made of cardboard and it costs a few bucks and it allows you to...
You mean it's inexpensive?
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's made of cardboard.
So
there are a range of virtual reality goggles out there in the market, ranging in pricing from the very cheap to the extremely expensive. And just getting into that experience of virtual reality is something that I'm excited about.
Have you tried it?
No, never.
Okay, so the immersive quality of the virtual reality thing is the trick, right? How...
is it, exactly how real that. It is. It's tricking you. It's, you know, being sensationalized by the techies that are out there. But I want to try it out since it's so cheap.
You know, because right? you know, science fiction writers have been anticipating this for the longest time. I think Aldous Huxley in that novel Brave New World, you know, anticipates it in this thing called the Feelies. It's like a movie. It's like a cinema where you kind of it's an immersive technology. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really elaborate on the technology, but it suggests that because the people who go to the Feelies also drink something called Soma, which. If you look into Hindu mythology and you know, sacred texts, Soma is a kind of nectar of the gods, and mm-hmm. so you know, and so the idea is that the people are ingesting some sort of opiate. They're becoming
just to escape. A form of escapism.
That's right. This is a way of controlling people, right? And so the Brave New World's premise is that we're all being controlled by these
not
structures.
That we're not already with our respective gadgets, the current gadgets that we have right
or
now.
Or watching endless
cat videos.
Cat videos. I think that's certainly a sign of totalitarianism.
Very Matrix-like, right? If you remember that movie Matrix, I think
absolutely.
One of the
Keanu
players.
Reeves.
Yeah. And one of them, even upon realizing that his mind is being controlled, chose to have his mind controlled because he didn't want to get out of that nice feeling that the Matrix provided.
Yeah, so this is the conundrum, you know, in Dostoevsky's book, you know, The Brothers Karamazov, you know, there's a chapter called The Grand...
You're so aware of these things. And
Inquisitor?
No, you would be one of those who would not get those VR goggles.
I don't know. Actually, you're wrong. I love the immersive thing. I mean, you know, and I remember there was a recent movie where they also gave you some sort of spectacles when you went to watch it because it was taking you to a new level of immersive tech, you know, of experience. But the problem is that as soon as you get into that, you know, maybe for the first few minutes it might seem different, but after a while your brain just normalizes everything and then you're just there, you know, and you stop seeing yourself outside from the experience.
Well, Sharad, you are talking about books. And I think that some of those books that you recommended, I would love to read because I think they're classics. I think I've read Aldous Huxley. But recently, I also read a book called Stealing Fire. And this is about how to achieve peak performance through some kind of altered state of cognitive ability.
Oh.
And
Stealing Fire?
Stealing Fire.
Okay.
It's a bestseller currently, I believe. Oh. But really, in it, what it talks about is that people today spend so much money trying to chase this altered state through products such as coffee, and you talk about opiates. You know, there are other forms of escapism that are, you know, at our disposal today. Facebook, Twitter, all these social media, when we engage them, allow us to have our hormones, you know, some of these hormones kick in, dopamine and what have you, kick in to make us feel better and to make us feel kind of out of this world. Movies, you know, the money people spend on movies. And so this guy, the author, calculated the amount of money that's spent on just altered states of being amount to trillions and trillions of dollars. And it can be something as mundane as coffee
or sugar to
something as illegal as illicit drugs.
Okay, so here it is. It's Stephen Kotler and Jamie Wheel, Stealing Fire, How Silicon Valley, the Navy SEALs, and Maverick Scientists Are Revolutionizing the Way We Live and Work. Is that the book?
Yes,
wow,
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it gets a 4.19 star rating on Goodreads.
I didn't really enjoy the read, though, because I was just trying to skim through it for ideas.
Okay.
But
we'll do is we'll put this out on Twitter so you get a link to the story. Now, very quickly, on Current Affairs, which comes after the 8:30 news, we look at the Football Association of Malaysia, some waves being made by the new president, because the Tunku Mahathir of Johor, President Tunku Ismail Sultan Ibrahim, who took that position some 10 days ago, and he's made waves by reverting the national squad's name to its original name of Harimau Malaya, implementing a cost-cutting exercise with an FAM, and apparently empowering fans. So all that big drama in football and such a long lead up to the conclusion, because we had so much drama, if you remember, over the last year or so with the Tunku Makoto challenging, those the incumbents, as it were, in the football world.
I think Malaysians really pined for those glory days in sports, especially from some of our older listeners. They will remember the football heydays of the 70s, and that's where that movie became so popular.
Ola Bola,
right? Yeah. Everyone sort of related to that because they remember. And I think the Malaysian sports needs such a catalyst.
Yeah. I mean, typically, though, in kind of harking or kind of wishing for, the glory days, there's a bit of myth-making. And because you remember the Ola Bola, there was a bit of controversy because in this particular game, the winning shot was actually done by a Sabahan, but, they turned it into a Peninsula Malay. I mean, it's just all these kinds of extraordinary myth-making that goes into the return to glory days. Whereas, maybe the issue really is to look forward. I mean, how would you look forward? I'm not quite sure with football. But certainly the politics of football in Malaysia is fairly interesting. I mean, it's got enough, its cast of characters make it worthy of a mini-series, I think.
In fact, this change of name, I think it's so interesting because they're changing it from Harimau Malaysia to Harimau Malaya. Which suggests some throwback to colonialism in the name Malaya versus Malaysia,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because Malaya also refers to just the peninsula, right? So West Malaysia, Peninsula Malaysia, was the Federation of Malaya. And so I think, this may be an issue around how inclusive is this old name, especially from at a time when we've become much more conscious that Sabah and Sarawak have been marginalized in the national narrative. Everything is kind of peninsula-centric. So I don't know. I like to see how and where this all goes. Julian, today on the S&M show, you have a guest, Suresh Ramanathan, an independent FX or Forex strategist, and you're going to be speaking to him about bond short selling. So in about 20 minutes or so, if you could just do that, tell us what a bond short
selling
is.
In about 20 minutes, that's the entire show.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, recently, Bank Negara was talking about opening up the bond market to short selling. And of course, short selling is a dirty word in Malaysia since the Asian financial crisis of 97, when Prime Minister Mahathir at the time reversed a lot of the financial development and regulation in Malaysia. And one of that included the banning of short selling. And it has been gradually reallowed in the stock market, but not without its impediments. And right now, they're opening this up to the bond market because they feel that the foreigners have been put off by recent Bank Negara rulings about the happenings in the NDF market, right, the non-deliverable forward markets, which are really agreements that foreign investors or foreign speculators or traders or whatever you want to call them make that's outside of Bank Negara control. Think of it as like the Bitcoin of bond trading or ringgit trading in Malaysia. And because Bank Negara tried to put a stop to that, and because it was very effective, the volumes of NDF trading for the ringgit has died down a lot, that it also affected the bond market. Right? Okay.
So bonds are exclusively issued by governments, are they? Is that what we're looking at?
Not exclusively, but we're really talking about Malaysian sovereign bonds and Malaysian corporate bonds here right now not receiving the kind of love that they can get from foreigners. And this is important since we're also recently discussing South Africans' junk bond status, right? Mm-hmm. For Malaysia, they need for the foreigners to buy into this so that when we want to raise money... For development or any other corporates who want to raise money would find that immediate response from foreign investors. And now they are being deterred from getting the market because there is no way for them to hedge their positions.
So I look forward to this. I'm going to learn a lot. I think I'm making you fall asleep already. Thank you very much. I asked. I gave you 20 minutes, and you took only two.
Yeah.
And I think
that's me. I aim to please.
Yeah, you do. We'll come back. We'll do a quick catch up on the news, including a look at South Africa. You just mentioned just now. Also, a new party, Party Bebas Raswa. Corruption-free party, I think. Maybe it's a
that's
bad
novel.
Transition.
that's a novel idea.
Yeah, that's the name of the party. The issue of the internet and the web creator who's attacking both the British and American plans to weaken encryption and such and net neutrality. All this will be we'll discuss when we get back after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues, and that was I Want You to Want Me by Cheap Trick. And I'm not quite sure, but it sounds like a band from a long time ago. I'll wait for some notes to come in on Cheap Trick, though. I'm guessing, what's your guess? Do you think it's from the 80s, 70s, 80s, or 90s?
I don't know, but I must say that Cheap Tricks are still very alive and kicking today, very relevant.
Well, Cheap Tricks is one thing. This is Cheap Trick.
Okay.
And yeah, from
it's
the
70s. It's a one-trick pony.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think they were actually, they really did make a name for themselves, you know, this band.
Okay.
Cheap Trick, yeah. Did go on to be quite a well-known established band from the 70s. The time that, you know, some of us in this studio at least were not
already developed,
not even born.
Developed some awareness.
They weren't even an aspiration on anybody's part in the 70s. Okay, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Julian Ng. Clearly, men of some vintage. I know you would deny this, but there you have it. I've said it, Julian. Okay, in the news, Julian, overnight as we slept in our beds, innocent to all that was happening in the world, Nivea, the cosmetic brand, removed their White is Purity deodorant advert because it was creating controversy for them and it was branded racist.
Cheap Trick, right? It's a Cheap Trick. Just something bait and switch to make you buy into something, and it's really something else when you get to buy into it. But, you know, Sharad, before you want to go into this, I'm just a Cheap Trick is still in my head, and I want to ask this question about South Africa a little bit because so much is happening over there.
Okay,
I promise this will be short because the finance minister over there who wanted good for the nation was sacked.
Pravin Gordhan, yeah.
And my question is whether he's going to form a new political party to challenge the president, and whether President Zuma, the incumbent president now in South Africa, would conspire to jail him. Because that there is a lesson here to be learned from a certain country in Southeast Asia.
Sure. Well, they do these things. Okay, well, you know, the latest news, Julian, actually, on South Africa is that South Africa's very powerful trade union federation, COSATU, has called for President Jacob Zuma to step down. In fact, it looks like he's losing his allies very quickly. So maybe the danger isn't that former finance minister Pravin Gordhan is going to be jailed, but that Jacob Zuma is going to be ousted. Apparently, the Secretary General of COSATU has said that Jacob Zuma is no longer the right person to lead the country. You know, COSATU, the African National Congress, ANC, the South African Communist Party are all kind of stalwarts in the struggle against apartheid. And they all have deserted him. So the South African Communist Party has already called for his removal. So it looks like Dick Zuma's days might be numbered unless he goes down the authoritarian route.
Yeah, which is very easy to do insidiously.
Maybe, but you know, South Africa, as I understand it, Julian, I might be wrong, but has some very strong institutions. I mean, coming out of apartheid, you know, South Africa really led the way in terms of constitutional developments and, you know, institution building and such. So,
we shall see.
They resilient? Can they withstand, you know, somebody wanting
to power stand, to the people, right?
Yeah, and to the institutions that.
So, I promise that this will be short. From apartheid, let's go into white purity.
Okay, well, also, I must say, there's a, you know, for people who don't like these political stories. Let me tell you, there is a lot of drama in this, including something called the Guptas. And the Guptas are this Indian family that moved to South Africa in the 90s, and they established themselves becoming like the sixth richest people of South Africa with their businesses. And they're the ones who are part of the story of Jacob Zuma's fall, basically preying on his weaknesses, you know, and corrupting him. And so, you know, the Gupta family is real melodrama again, you know. And if you're not interested in politics but you love melodrama, this is a story to follow. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll put a link.
While you wait for the next season of House of Cards, you can read the South African story.
Yes, you can. Okay, coming back to the story of Nivea's White is Purity deodorant ad. Now, apparently the German skincare brand has in fact apologized. Now, it doesn't just remove it. It apologized for what has been said to be racist. The ad, apparently, for its invisible deodorant range, said White is Purity, and it was put across an image of a woman, and it was posted on the firm's Facebook page, and it's also said to be misleading. So, I mean, I know sometimes I think we all get into the tears about these things. I mean, should something like this, White is Purity, be read as racist, you know?
Well, I am slightly confused because this is supposed to be a deodorant, and deodorants, the last I checked, have no color. So, well, be that as it may, but I just to answer your question, Sharad, yeah, I do think so, because there is this preoccupation with colors. I don't think that is conducive for the world today. I don't think we should be so preoccupied with the color of the skin.
As a brand,
I think you should be very careful on treading such grounds. And I think that as a brand, and if you have any brand ambassadors out there, you should promote unity in saying that it doesn't matter what skin color you are, you should be accepted, rather than pander to this desire to be white. And this white is over-marketed, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, but you see it all over. I mean, you go into the LRT, there are all these adverts for, you know, whitening your armpits. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. I mean,
Really?
No, you see those ads, they're there.
While you're standing next to a person who has his hand held up
high. And
the rails.
And you do hope that they've used some sort of deodorant or they naturally smell nice. But
you don't really think of the color of their armpits, though.
No, but
I don't think it doesn't mean that because it's happening, it's right.
But okay, but let's put it this way. There is this whole phenomenon, right, with people, especially with Photoshop and the way in which you can retint your skin color. I noticed that on a lot of social media, the profiles of people really lighten their skin. I mean, it is, you know, I can see Lynn Mark there in the news studio waiting to read the news coming up very shortly, agreeing with me. It is, people actually lighten their skin. And then there's all this kind of demand for having your skin tone even.
What about
your
body, you, Sharad? Do you Photoshop yourself? Because you have a very nice brown tone.
No, I don't. Because I don't think I consciously do it. But
consciously?
No, I don't do it. I'm not on Facebook. Whatever.
No, but back to the question, is this right or wrong? I don't think it's right, because I think that you should be comfortable with how you look. And already there's so many problems with the
world.
Okay,
so the thing is, why do companies continue to do this? Get themselves into a mess by, you know, creating this backlash and then backpedaling, you know, removing ads. I mean, is this some perverse way of, you know, raising the profile? We'd never be talking about Nivea without this controversy, right? So is this some perverse way?
Or is it not learning?
I don't think
it's a case where any publicity is good publicity here. Look, we have seen of late that activism has become a very good branding exercise, a very good PR exercise when you stand up and say what is right and what is not right, right? We've seen that recently with many of these ads, and they also get the kind of social media buy-ins that are very good for the branding. So today it's all about putting forward what you believe is right or wrong, And I think that in the first place, it was wrong for Nivea to promote that kind of color-based advertisements. And secondly, it was perhaps right for them to take it out, maybe even furtively take it out. It's not wrong for them to do
that. I agree with you, but I think we also should lighten up, not be so concerned with what these big corporations do, and just carry on with our lives.
True,
and be
as
empowered.
Well.
You know, black is beautiful. Brown is beautiful, and you know every other skin tone is beautiful. Just forget these big companies. Anyway, we'll be back with more after the first bulletin of the day, which is coming up very shortly with Lynn Mark at the microphone, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was The Best by Tina Turner. Tina Turner, of course, decidedly 60s and 70s in her first incarnation. And then she kind of disappeared, and then she reappeared in the 80s. So people
as the rocking grandmother.
That's right. I mean, I don't know if that's demeaning, but it certainly...
Not at all. I think you should be proud of that. I mean, if you became granddad and you were still rocking in your 80s, into your 70s.
I think a lot of, you know, Phil Collins, I don't know if he's in his 70s yet, but he's still rocking. I mean, you know, there are a lot of... I think musical talent, it doesn't go away with age, generally. Though, you know, I think with Britney Spears, it really did have a tragic effect on her. But she had a different type of talent. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
The 80s would be the new 30s.
What you mean? Being 18, the 80s would be like...
In about 10 years' time, people will consider 80-year-olds still very young and energetic.
I think with Tina Turner, she just kept herself so well. And, you know, she's a Buddhist, and she meditates and all that, and that really does
What
help
about
you.
Madonna? I mean, she has kind of dropped out of the scene recently, but she's one of those evergreen stars.
I don't know about Madonna. I must say, you know, I'm not a big fan now of what she's gone on to do. But we'll put that aside and come to the controversy of the morning. So we had the Nivea cream ad that, you know, was branded racist, and there was all this backpedaling. Julian, you know, we had this other story that came out yesterday where a Barisan National lawmaker, Tasik Glugo MP Datuk Shahbudin Yahya, in rebutting Dr. Siti Maria Mahmud, the Amana candidate, MP of Kota Raja, he went out to say that he thinks, rape victims marrying their rapists is okay. In fact, he went on to suggest that even some 9-year-olds were physically and spiritually ready for marriage. Now, of course, this has created a storm on social media and Twitter and beyond. And I just take one example. There was a Elfie Sharudin wrote on Twitter. He says, "I want to rape MP Tasik Glugo. Then I would propose to him." He says in quotes, "See how ridiculous that sounds?" Exactly.
Totally.
So I think that is the kind of outrage people say. It's just, it does not make sense. But I'm wondering, because I'm assuming, Julian, you and I are probably with the crowd in this and saying that it's an outrageous statement, but there's still people out there who might actually see some sense in what the MP is saying, or they might be focused on other issues. And I'm wondering, you know, is it even possible to enter sympathetically into what they're thinking in order to understand why is it that people continue to make these kinds of statements?
I think you can go on and explore the strategy and tactic in this kind of political grandstanding, right?
Because you think that's what it is?
I don't know, but I think that is highly irresponsible. This is going back to what I said about the Nivea white purity campaign, right? If it's wrong, you should just call a spade is wrong. And as a politician who is responsible for your voters and your constituents and putting yourself out there as a leader, you shouldn't pander to the crowd no matter how many votes it will get you. I think that's totally wrong.
So you think
he was irresponsible, totally stupid.
Right. So you think he's pandering to a majority
sentiment?
I'm
not saying that he is, but certainly if we assume, we give him the credit for a well-thought-out tactic, right, which I totally would not do that for him. If he did that... then it's highly irresponsible. But if he didn't do that, and if he's just shooting off his mouth, then it's even worse.
Okay, so I'm thinking that where this person might be coming from is that he's thinking, okay, the deed is done, and he's thinking about those families and the victim, right? And because we have this idea that's still very dominant, prevalent in this country, that if you've been raped, that somehow you're spoiled goods, that somehow you're not going to be able to conduct yourself as a full human being, that you're damaged. And because of that, there's this idea of how do we salvage the situation? Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the one side, the family needs to achieve some resolution for the girl child, and they say, well, maybe the best way is to say, well, since they've already consummated this this relationship,
that's not the kind of.
I'm just trying to follow the logic.
If you read the news reports, and you look at his quotes, and I quote here. When we discuss 12 and 15-year-olds, we don't see their physical bodies because some children aged 12 or 15, their bodies are like 18-year-old women. So he's not even trying to have a sociological justification for child marriages. He's just looking at their bodies and he's saying they don't look like 12 or 15 years old. They look like 18 years old. So it's okay to marry them. I mean, what kind of leader make that kind of stupid statement?
Okay, so I think, where he so clearly is not thinking this sufficiently, thinking through this sufficiently, is in understanding what the act itself, rape, is, and especially statutory rape, right? Where the participants in it might have had some sort of relationship, but by law, there can be no consent when you engage sexually with a minor.
Absolutely. And the law is there for a reason. Yeah. It's to protect children.
That's right. Yeah. So they're to protect children and women. And I think...
It's an objective test. It's not a subjective test, right? The law does not want to engage in a kind of subjective test. Imagine if we retrograde and go back, turn back time and reverse all this progress that we have made with slavery, with monopolistic companies, with women's rights, for instance. I mean, this world would be a crazy place. Trying to justify slavery, for example, looking into the sociological aspects of slavery and trying to justify it would be crazy in today's time.
Yeah, okay. So then the question is, and we have this issue in Malaysia, which is child marriages, right? Or very young people getting married, often to other young people. But and it happens in, say, rural areas and where, maybe communities are much smaller and there is a concern about, regulating the sexual lives of the young. There is this curious, and I think it's a very flawed way of thinking about it, but there's this idea that, family honor and social cohesion is established by just marrying people off, making sure that whatever it is they're in these relationships and they're not freewheeling individuals. I think that's one of the things. But you're right about, I think you're right about this this MP. I do think he seems to miss the mark on so many issues. One is the consent issue. Two, if a man is has forced himself, unaware of the law or in violation of the law, could he ever make a suitable husband? I mean, why would you marry your child off to somebody who violates law? It's like saying, oh, yeah, I'll give my child to, a criminal. I mean, it just does not make sense. I mean, how viable would that marriage be, even if it's kind of gives some legality to that act, in kind of
absolutely.
Retro?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm not quite sure what else is there to kind of understand in this mix,
I also am quite worried about how this is being used by the powers, because we need to have a kind of, and I'm going to sound like a broken record here, because we need to have good redistributive policies. When you raise taxes from GST, when you curb corruption, and Ezamno has started this party.
Party Bebas Rasuah.
Okay, so the fact that you name your party after a very specific political campaign, which is to eradicate corruption, I mean, it says something about the country, right? That this is this is novel, like a political party against corruption.
Yeah, a single platform party.
So this is the thing, right? Are you leaving disenfranchising? And this is disenfranchisement in the true sense of the word, because if you're not having good redistributive policies, you disenfranchise people, right? And you continue to corner them into the kind of a very parochial ethnic environment, and they can't break out of that. And then you try to justify that with something else. And I think that is very, very sinister and very insidious. We must do something to reverse that, as we have done with other principles, like, you know, I go back to slavery, anti-monopolism, feminism, women's rights, and so on.
But, you know, we see every day challenges to the kind of consensus we thought we once had, right? Look at climate change. Just with the move, you know, with the election of Donald Trump, you see one of the biggest economies in the world now, you know, pushing back on climate change, and you know, and siding with the lunatic fringe that says there is no climate change.
And Donald Trump has gaslighted an entire nation, making them doubt their own sanity. Even the liberals, even the progressives, are asking right now, "Hey, have we done something wrong here? Maybe Donald Trump is right." You know, no, I mean, the world is getting warmer. The climate problems are a fact. You know, you got to keep to that. And child marriages are wrong. Raping of children is wrong.
Right. Well, you know, this is a conversation that's going to go on. And I'm wondering what the leadership of UMNO, from which the MP comes from, are going to say to this, to one of their own, following this controversy. We look forward to the unfolding of this story. But before we come up to the news, which is up at the top of the hour, we'll have a song by Blind Melon. Now, this is clearly a contemporary band. Not Cheap Trick, but Blind Melon. So this is a fruit. Sorry, it's from the 90s, apparently. So that's some time ago. Blind Melon is from the 90s, the 90s band. So it's a disabled fruit. Yeah, okay. And the song is called No Rain. Here it is, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.